Okay, I'm looking at the clock. It's time. People who are not with us will have to log in soon. I want to begin. Well, first, I have two corrections from last class, but before I do that, I mentioned we are going through some stories of there are seven records of Rav Chaim, and I mentioned the name of Rav Simcha Zelig, the Dayan of Brisk, Simcha Zelig Rieger, and I said that he didn't dress in rabbinic garb. I thought it would be interesting to show you what he looked like. We have a number of pictures of him. Here on the screen is one such picture, and you can see very clearly he's not wearing the rabbinic garb. He's not wearing the typical hat. And we have, like I said, we have other pictures, and he always wore that hat. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik himself didn't wear the typical rabbinic garb. There was a time in America where it was very clear who was the rabbi and who wasn't. The Rav would be one who dressed in black with a hat. Why rabbis dress in black, I'm not sure. The Gemara doesn't have such positive things to say about wearing black. It says that if you there's a sin you want to commit, you go someplace where no one knows you, you wear black, which I guess is a non-distinctive color, and then you commit the sin. It's, in other words, it's not giving you a heter to do it, but it's saying that if you're going to do it anyway, better to do it in a place where you won't make a chil Hashem, no one knows you, than to do it in a place where they know you. For some reason, as far as I know, no one has written a study of how, beginning, let's say, in the 70s, in Haredi society, it became so conformist. I'm not referring to the Hasidim that have always been conformist to this matter, but Lithuanian society, which has always been about independent thinking and nonconformity, a little bit of cynicism, how Lithuanian society also became enamored with the black clothes, which, as if you know, if you look at the old pictures, that it wasn't for the masses. Today, you go into a typical yeshivish type of minyan, and everyone is wearing rabbinic garb. You can't tell who the rabbi is because everyone's in black and suits and black hats. Sometimes the rabbi will have a long black coat, and that will identify him. But many times not, sometimes only on Shabbos. And often you have the average people who are in who have long coats as well. So this rabbinic garb isn't as significant today, but it was significant in Europe. And here we have a picture of Rav Simcha Zelig, who didn't wear rabbinic garb. Rabbi Soloveitchik also, by the way, didn't wear rabbinic garb. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik didn't wear a typical rabbinic garb. One of the few pictures we have of Rav Moshe, one of the well-known pictures, is he's standing up with a sefer in his hand, and he has a light jacket. You could probably easily find that picture online. Yes, Baruch points out, the Chafetz Chaim as well wore a cap. And the Chafetz Chaim might have said, well, I'm not a Rav, which he wasn't. He didn't serve as the Rav of his Kehila. But yes, the Chafetz Chaim wore a cap just a little bit like this. And we have others as well. Baruch says that Lithuanians, the old days, dressed similar to Hasidim. What you refer to in Lithuanians dressed more multicolored was a short-lived aberration. I'm not referring to multicolored in the sense of wearing blue or red or anything like that. I'm referring to the fact, obviously, if you go back 150 years, Lithuanians wore typical peasant type of clothing. But if you look at the yeshiva world, the way yeshiva bachrim dressed, they dressed stylishly. And in the 20th century, in my next Sfarim blog post, which hopefully will be up tonight or tomorrow, I talk about the development of a Torium Derech Eretz type of Lithuanian society. But yes, in the 19th century, no one had money. They all dressed poor and they dressed like peasants. But the rabbis had a rabbinic garb. But here you see Rav Simcha Zelig. He looks just like a typical peasant or a typical illiterate Jew, not dressed in any, not dressed as befitting his station. And there's another picture I found online of Rav Simcha Zelig walking with two other rabbanim, and he's still dressed like this as well. Yes, and yes, Chaim, you're right that, it's Baruch says the altar of Sabak. Yes, the altar of Sabak did innovate this, 100%. But I'm talking about this has already been going on in the 20th century. The people today in the yeshivas, they're not going back to early 19th century because the clothing is stylish clothing. What's unique about it is that it's black. What the altar did was that he innovated and that they should dress in accord with modern styles, Western style suits. And they dressed in all different, they dressed in gray and white and all different things. So that was an innovation. But I'll say the same point, the innovation of, in the beginning of the 1970s, to have everyone dress in Western suits, which was itself an innovation 80 years before, but to have them dress in black suits was itself an innovation. And the Sfardim, they picked up on it as well, very quickly. Now, Chaim said, and there's yet to be an article written on this, and is this an influence of the Hasidic movement? Does this go along with that, or is it a response to, you know, the hedonisms of the 60s, that traditional societies reverted to a more conservative dress? I'm not sure. Chaim, you said that you've heard claims that beginning in the 70s, Lithuanian yeshivas became populated by the majority, in the majority by descendants of Hungarian Hasidim. I don't know. I find that hard to believe that that's the case. I don't think that's the case. I think most of the Hungarians were not going to the Lithuanian yeshivas. If you talk about the Hasidic Hungarians and the non-Hasidic Hungarians, they did not dress... They dressed also, they dressed modern. If you went to a place like Pressburg in the 1930s, they were dressed just like Lithuanian yeshiva students, in regular clothes. And Yisrael says the trends today completely in black, even the women. Ever since people started dressing in modern clothes towards the end of the 19th century, no one in Lithuania dressed as black. That's a Hasidim did, but this is a relatively new thing. But obviously, Baruch is correct. If you go back 200 years before, Hasidim Misnagdim wore strimals. The Vilna Gaon would have wore a strimal. Everyone dressed a certain way. But beginning in the 19th century, mid-19th century, they start dressing more modern, and those who had money, who were more enlightened, you had a whole religious Haskala types in places like Vilna and Kovno. And by the end of the 19th century, you have the Altar of Sobotka actually pushing this. And by the, certainly by the 20s, in the big cities in Lithuania, you already had the development of a modern, sort of like a modern Orthodox group in Lithuania. And I'm not going to speak more about this now, because we can talk maybe next week. You'll see my post that's coming up. But yes, 100%. If you went back to the even the mid-19th century, in the small towns, the typical Lithuanian, just look at Fiddler on the Roof. I guess that's, I don't know if that's Lithuania, but they all looked pretty much the same. And many of them, if you go back even earlier, would have wore strimals. We have pictures, by the way. We have paintings, etc. I want to now... mention correct two errors. I thank Baruch for pointing out one of them. Let me get a picture here of Rav Zevin. Today I think will be the last class on Rav Zevin. It's Russia. I know it's Russia, but I don't know what part of Russia it's supposed to be. It's all Russia, obviously. I don't know if it's Western Russia, more like Lithuania. It doesn't really matter, because the typical Lithuanian Jew would look like that as well. Anatevka, I don't know where Anatevka is supposed to be. I realize it's in Russia, but, you know, Lithuania was also part of Russia. But granted, okay, let's assume it's part of Russia. The first thing, last class I spoke about Chich. And this is not Chust. Someone asked me, is it Chust? I said I thought that the Maram Shik was Ravin Chust. I checked it. He was. And I told the story about the woman who got pregnant and said it was from a demon. And I mentioned that she was a teenage girl. And someone asked me for a copy of the article. So I looked at it. And lo and behold, I was mistaken. She actually, it's been a long time since I looked at it. She was a married woman. So here you have a married woman who gets pregnant. And in order to cover herself and so that she was not engaged in an adulterous affair, she invents this story that a demon impregnated her. And that's the story of Chich. And as I said, there's families today who are descended from Chich. The other correction I want to make, and that's, I have to thank Baruch for correcting me. Let me remind you, last semester I mentioned that the Baranovich Yeshiva, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's Yeshiva, had a Hasidic component, and a significant Hasidic component, and the basis for my saying this was what the late Professor Ben Zion Wachholder told me. And he actually told me that on Nitzel, on Christmas Eve, they didn't learn, which is unique among the Lithuanian yeshivos. And the reason given was, if I recall correctly, was that there was a number of Hasidim who were at this yeshiva. I also said that David Katz, in his book, actually included Baranovich as one of these yeshivas that's half Misnagdic, half Hasidish. I said that in addition to give support to the idea that the Wachholder mentioned that the Hasidic element in Baranovich. And last class, two classes ago, I actually showed you from a book that David Katz wrote, the picture of the different yeshivos, and where it had Baranovich as half Hasidic, half Misnagdic. I was so excited to see this picture and that it supported what Wachholder said that I didn't actually pay close attention to the picture. And Baruch pointed out correctly, 100%, I just looked at the picture again and I saw it that had I looked at the name of, here, let me show it to you again. I have the picture right here. It's my recollection. Let's see. You're right. He's right. He's right. It's my mistake. It's Baranovich right there next to Slonim. Yes. I so quickly, I didn't even look at the name of the yeshiva. The name of Rabbi Chanan's yeshiva was Ohel Torah. He even published a Torah journal named Ohel Torah. And all you have to do is look closely underneath there, and it tells you, you see the name Weinberg. This was not the Lithuanian yeshiva. Rather, this is a Slonimer yeshiva, so obviously it's a Hasidic yeshiva. And I thank Baruch for correcting me. As I said, I was in an effort to mention how that there were Hasidim there. I quickly PDF'd that page without even bother reading the name of the yeshiva there. So thank you very much, Baruch. Okay, no more corrections now, although I'm sure I'll get some. I want to pick up where we left off. Let me pull up the Great Rav Zevin here again on the screen. Now, that's the article I told you about on the drafting of yeshiva students, but we did that, so we don't need to see that again. I can send anything I mention. As you know, I can always send PDFs of it to you. I want to continue. I mentioned we saw some stories last class, stories that to a certain extent Rav Zevin made famous. I even looked at the book on the Rav by Rakefet, and the story I mentioned last week about the Get and Rav Yitzchak Hanan, Rakefet quotes it actually, not from Rav Soloveitchik, he quotes it from Rav Zevin. There's a few other stories I'll mention before we go on that Rav Zevin made famous as well in yeshiva circles, so let me get to them. This is on page 48 in my edition. This is a great one. Rav Chaim, the way the story is told is that Rav Chaim was in the middle of davening. This was at the Sunday morning. And a Jew came to ask a question. Rav Chaim was davening, but there was another Rav right next to him. So he asked the other Rav the question that on Motzei Shabbos, he forgot to daven Ma'ariv, or he was forced, he couldn't daven Ma'ariv, and therefore Sunday morning, he has to do two Shmon Esrei's. The first one is the Shacharis. We always know that the first one is the Shacharis, or the first one is the one you're supposed to daven, and the second one is Tashlumin, make up. So the second Shmon Esrei is to make up a Motzei Shabbos. His question is, in which tefillah, in which Shmon Esrei, does he say Atachonantanu? By the way, the reasons that are going to be given, you can then use it to apply. You can have the same argument about all sorts of things, Alanisim, whatever you want. And the Rav, who heard the question, because Rav Chaim was in the middle of davening, his opinion was, and he was saying, that obviously you say at Takonan Tandu in the second Shmon Esrei, because that's the second one is the Tashlumin in the makeup one. The first one is it's the regular Shacharis. Rav Chaim, according to what Rav Zevin tells us, even though he was davening himself, he overheard, and he told them to wait till he was done davening, and when he was done, he gave this explanation, which again is his classic Brisker explanation, quoted often, and I think it's usually quoted from Rav Zevin. He says, why do we say Atachonon Tanu in Motzei Shabbos? We say it not because we're saying the Shmona Esrei of Motzei Shabbos, but because this is the first tefillah, the first Amida after Shabbos. He says, if you could imagine a case where Sunday tefillah is said before Motzei Shabbos, then you would say Atachonon Tanu then. And lo and behold, now we have a case where Sunday Shmona Esrei is actually before Motzei Shabbos, and therefore you have to say Atachonon Tanu in the first one because it's Sunday. So that's what Rav Zevin quotes. The next thing I want to mention, page 52, this is perhaps the most famous halachic viewpoint of Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim has many halachic viewpoints. If you look in Nefesh HaRav or some other books, you see a lot of them. And the tradition of Rav Chaim, as I mentioned already, was that these were halachic decisions for private, for his family, for important students. These were not halachic decisions for the masses, for everyone else. I already quoted how Rav Zevin explains this view of Rav Chaim, and there were some radical viewpoints. For example, Rav Chaim held, I mentioned this before, it's mentioned in Nefesh HaRav, that with the exception of Yom Kippur, there is no obligation anymore to fast on any of the fast days because of we're all considered sick people, cholim. And I mean, you can imagine that if you publicize such a position, and we even have testimony, I've gone through it before, that Ravelvo Halacha Lamaisa held this, either on Shiva Seva Tammuz or Tisha B'Av, and you have a number of these, for the Briskers wouldn't wear tzitzis on Shabbos, because they held that if you don't have Techeles, then you walk outside in Rosh Hashanah, it's not, it's considered carrying, at least that's how it's reported. Here's an example of where the Shulchan Aruch says there's no problem. And we have examples of this as well, where the Shulchan Aruch says one thing and Rav Chaim says something else, but that's Rav Chaim's position. And he disagreed with the Shulchan Aruch, but it was private. Baruch, you said about the fasting. This is quoted in Rav Hershel Schechter, and I investigated with him about this. He put me in touch with the late Aaron Schreiber. Aaron Schreiber, who's a son, by the way, and I then later spoke to his son about this at a little bit in length, and anyone can call him up. His son is the one who's published a number of volumes of the book called Nora Os HaRav. And Aaron Schreiber told how Rav Simcha Sheps, who was Rosh Yeshiva, it was in Tor Vadas, he recalled, and I have to go to my notes to get the details, walking into the Brisker Rav's house, and it was either Shiva Sarva Tammuz or Tisha B'Av, I think it was Shiva Sarva Tammuz, and Ravelvo was eating. And Rav Schechter tied this into the idea that Rav Chaim held that today there's no obligation at all to fast. Now, Schreiber told me that when he told this story to... it was actually Shiva Sarva Tammuz, that's my memory. When he told this story to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron said, it's not because of any shita, it's because Ravelvo was sick, and therefore he had to eat. But so I don't know if anyone ever paskened l'maisa, according to Rav Chaim in this, but according to what's brought down by Rav Schechter, that Rav Chaim held that, at least in theory, halacha, no one is obligated to fast today except on Yom Kippur, because we all have the status of Chol HaShe'em Bo Sakan. And this idea that we're all weak ties into what I'm going to tell you now. Of course, this idea, which I just mentioned to you, and there's other examples as well, are not in line with the Shulchan Aruch. And the one I'm going to give you now is a complete divergence from the Shulchan Aruch. And it's perhaps the only example where Rav Chaim paskened halacha l'maaseh. Remember, he's not generally a posek, But he decided, halacha l'maisa, not only did he decide, he told his son, Rav Moshe, when you become Rav, you have to decide like this. And here's an example of Rav Chaim, the only example I know, deciding for the masses, halacha l'maisa, in opposition to the Shulchan Aruch. Before we go on, okay, you say on a previous occasion you confirmed it was Tisha B'Av. Okay, I don't even remember. I have the notes because, and I suppose anyone can confirm this as well, with Rabbi Schreiber, but I'm going to write it down again. Now that you say that, Rodney, I do remember. I believe the story is as follows. Rav Schechter, I have a letter from Rav Schechter, and he says it was on Tisha B'Av. But then I asked Schreiber, this is my recollection, I have to check, and Schreiber said, no, it wasn't Shiva Seva Tammuz, it was actually Tisha B'Av, and he heard it directly from Rav Simcha Sheps. It's almost impossible today to verify these things directly from the family, because they won't tell you. They're afraid it'll come out, it'll look bad, but that's the story. And the way Schreiber, the late Aaron Schreiber, who himself was a big Talmud Chacham and knew what he was talking about, there's people listening to us right now who knew him. Unfortunately, he passed away rather suddenly and much too young. He was someone who heard this directly from Rav Simcha Sheps, and he told me how Rav Simcha Sheps said how shocked he was to walk in, and as he described, and not just Rav Velvo, but the family sitting down to eat. Bill says that tzitzis is based on the Baal Amor. The Rav Aaron did not wear tzitzis, the Rav did. I can't confirm this, but they say that in Jerusalem they don't wear tzitzis either. But the point is, Bill, all their shitas, by the way, are based on things. We're going to see now the shita I'm going to tell you is based on a Magid Mishnah, but the Shulchan Aruch says otherwise. So this tzitzis business is in opposition to the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Zevin begins on page 52 by saying that Rav Chaim was machmir for sick people on Shabbos. How was he machmir? He forbid them to fast. That's the chumrah. He would order them that if they're sick, they have to eat on Yom Kippur just like any other day. If you recall the Shulchan Aruch speaks about how you have to eat pachos l'shir, you eat a little bit less, you eat less than the shir, that's so that you're not violating. Rav Chaim said, no, you eat normally. And then he quotes how Rav Yehuda Lei Dan Yichya, one of the great European Rabbanim, didn't publish much, but he was a student of Rav Chaim, a Zionist, by the way, as were many of Rav Chaim's students. He told Rav Zevin that Rav Chaim told him that that when Rav Chaim became Rav and Brisk, he ordered the sick people, Sheish Bahem Sakana on Yom Kippur, not to eat Ben Chatzi Shir, but to eat whatever they want. And the other sages of Brisk, you know, they protested. They asked Rav Chaim, how can you do this? It's against HaShulchan Aruch. The Chol HaPoskim, B'Neged HaHara HaMukubelet. This is against the Shulchan Aruch, this is against all the Poskim, and this is against the Psak. Rav Chaim explained his reasoning, and they accepted what he said. Now, Dan Yichya never told Rav Zevin what the reason was, and perhaps Rav Chaim never told him his reason, but then Rav Zevin quotes Rav Velvo. Rav Velvo is in Jerusalem, from what, 1940 and on, the same time as Rav Zevin. And Rav Velvo explains the reason of Rav Chaim. It's based on the Lashon of the Rambam and the way it's explained by the Magid Mishnah. We don't need to go into it. What's important for us is the fact that, this story, then you get the whole idea that Rav Chaim is challenged and he says, I'm not mekel, I'm not lenient on Yom Kippur, I'm machmir on Dinei Nefashos. As I said, this story becomes famous, and I think probably because of Rav Zevin publicizing it. The next story, just two more stories I want to give you. Page 59, David Berger quoted this story. I'll explain to you why. This is the, everything I've told you now is authentic stories, eyewitnesses, either at Fresco Abramsky or other things. The story I'm going to tell you now is, it's famous. I don't know if it's true or if it's a legend about Reb Chaim, because the story is such that I don't know if any, there were any witnesses, but it's still a good story and a famous one. Reb Chaim was on a train once. And as was his way, he was by himself. He sat in the corner, you know, by himself. As a, so I don't know how anyone knew the story then. Maybe he told them later. But in any event, you should know that Reb Chaim, in terms of traveling on trains, another one of his unusual viewpoints, which is not shared by anyone else, we always assume that Kriyas HaTorah is a halacha on the tzibur. So if you have a tzibur on Monday morning, you have to read Torah. It's not on the individual. If I'm not there, it's not anything to do with me. But Reb Chaim held it's also on the individual, and therefore, if he was traveling on the train, he would be careful if he's coming to a city Monday morning where there's a Jewish community, he would get off the train to hear Kriyas HaTorah because he felt that that was also an obligation on the individual. I don't know of anyone else who held this, even especially to the extent that you have to get off the train and listen to it. But that's just another one of anyone who's been in Briskers. You know they have it. It's not just Reb Chaim. Reb Moshe came up with individual opinions. The whole idea about the Avelos, that the Briskers have to stick, or at least the American Briskers, have to stick Avelos into these categories. And that's the basis for Rabbi Soloveitchik saying you can shave during a Sfira and you can go swimming during the 9 days. That apparently goes back to Reb Moshe. At least that's how it's quoted, not Reb Chaim. And as far as I know, Reb Soloveitchik also innovated. I don't know this Brisker, I say this Brisker thing, this American Brisker thing, I don't know if they do this in Jerusalem, of standing up for Chazaras HaShatz, and that's part of the Kiyum. I don't know whether that goes back to Reb Chaim, or if that's Reb Moshe, or if that's something Reb Soloveitchik himself came up with, because Reb Soloveitchik did come up with things on his own also. So Shlomo says they don't. So the story is he's on the train, and there's a group of Jews around sitting with him. They don't know who he is. You got this old story. You have lots of stories like this on the train. Don't know who they are. Another famous story is the Chafetz Chaim. Someone is on the train with the Chafetz Chaim and starts praising the Chafetz Chaim. He's going to Rodin to see the great Chafetz Chaim. You know, I can't imagine the Chafetz Chaim was traveling on the train to Rodin by himself, without a shamas, without, but that's the story. And the man starts talking about how he's going to see the holy Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim says, he's not such a great man, this Chafetz Chaim, no, don't. And the other guy gets so offended, he starts rebuking and screaming at the Chafetz Chaim, you ignoramus, you idiot, because the Chafetz Chaim also dressed like a pashut Jew. How dare you say about the Chafetz Chaim that he's not so great, etc. And then the moral of the story is that when they get to Rodin, and lo and behold, who the Chafetz Chaim is, it's the simple Jew he was sitting next to, and the guy has to, of course, apologize to the Chafetz Chaim for treating him so poorly and speaking to him like he's an idiot, but the Chafetz Chaim obviously forgave him. Bill says there's a rather weird story of Rav Zevin at Rav Velvo's grandson Bris, and they fought violently. That I don't know. I don't know that story. If you can find it, I'll look in Nefesh HaRav. I don't recall the story, but I have Nefesh HaRav not with me. If you look behind me, you see I'm in my office, not at home. But I will check. I can't remember. Okay, so Rav Chaim's on the train. And lo and behold, there's a mumar, an apostate, who's trying to, I'm assuming it's an apostate, not a non-Jew, because a non-Jew doesn't speak Yiddish. So it's, and when you think of how many apostate Russian Jews there were, you can count them on one hand, I bet. Maybe on two hands. I mean, we're not talking about that many traditional Lithuanian Jews who became apostates. They became heretics and Zionists, but in the days of Reb Chaim, you didn't have many. We're going to see one in a minute. But okay, that's the story. So he tries to prove to Reb Chaim that Jesus is the Messiah. And Reb Chaim doesn't say anything. The story is he's arguing, and Reb Chaim just sitting there listening while he tries to prove it to the other Jews. And then, in the middle of this argument, he says that there was someone in the, one of the Jews says that, well, wait a second, the Tanaim lived in the days of Jesus. If they didn't think that he was the Messiah, how could you, all these years later, say that he's the Messiah? And the apostate replies that you can't trust the Tanaim because they were wrong. Look, Rabbi Akiva was wrong about Bar Kokhba. So how can you trust him? So Rav Chaim interrupts and says to the apostate, how do you know that Rabbi Akiva was wrong in thinking that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach? And the apostate replies, well, obviously he's wrong, because Bar Kokhba was killed. So clearly he couldn't have been the Mashiach. And Rav Chaim replies, ah, that's the proof that you're wrong. You acknowledge that if you're killed, you can't be the Mashiach. Simplistic argumentation. Anyone with any sophistication, any Christian, could have a reply to that. But that's the story. And David Berger, I still remember, shortly after the Lubavitcher Rebbe's death, it couldn't be more than a few months when the Messianism was going strong, he publishes something in the Jewish press. It maybe was his first article against Lubavitch Messianism, and he argues that the Rebbe can't Mashiach because he dies. This Reb Chaim. See, Rodney says, the moral of the Chafetz Chaim story is that the Chafetz Chaim was said to comment that one may not even speak Lashon Hara about oneself. Yes, that's how, not all versions, I don't think, but at least some of the versions is that the Chafetz Chaim realized that he was mistaken. Because had he not spoke Lashon Hara about himself, said about himself that, he's not really that important, then all this controversy wouldn't have started. The man wouldn't have screamed at him, etc. That is the, I believe only one of the versions. If I'm not mistaken, not all the versions have that ending, and some just speak about the fact that the Chafetz Chaim, his great, humility and humbleness. Because the truth of the matter is, he wasn't speaking Lashon Hara about himself. Well, I guess he was, though, because it's one thing to, if they know who you are and you're modest, but to say about someone else who really is yourself, other people might think that's Lashon Hara. So I guess that is. In one of Louis Jacobs' articles, he deals with this idea of, he quotes a Marsha, if I recall, about Lashon Hara about yourself. Okay, and the final story I want to give you about Reb Chaim is on pages 60 and 61, where it talks about... one more story before I get to the last one. This is the one related to the apostate. I can't believe I skipped this one. This is a famous one. I can't see which page it's on here. But it deals with, give me a second here, 59, I think it's 52, it deals with Professor Chwolson, Chwolson. He was, as I try to find the story, I want to tell the story with it in front of me. Ah, here it is, yeah, it's on page 60. He was an apostate, one of the few. He becomes a leading professor, a scholar at the university, I think it was St. Petersburg, scholar in Oriental studies, that's Near Eastern studies, and one who helps the Jews, stands up for the Jews when it came to the blood libel, was really a friend of the Jewish community, although he was an apostate. And he was once asked, so we're told, Professor Chwolson, what did you believe that led you to convert to Russian Orthodoxy? And he replied, I believe that it's better to be a professor in St. Petersburg than a Muhammad in, substitute the name, Novozibko, Vonatevko, wherever you want. What happened was, on his jubilee, they made a big celebration, there's a jubilee volume, and the rabbis, the great rabbis, wanted to send Chwolson a letter, wishing him a mazel tov on his birthday, because he had done many good things for the Jewish people. And Reb Chaim refused. Reb Chaim said that we do not send letters of congratulations to a mumar. If I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes this in Halachic Man. At the same time, he also quotes the story of the Machlokas Rabbi the Rav Chaim had with the other Rabbanim at one of the conferences, I think one of the St. Petersburg conference, about can you include someone in the Jewish community register as part of the community if they're uncircumcised? And the other rabbis said, of course not, that we're going to make a siag. If someone doesn't circumcise his son, we're not going to count him as part of the community. And Reb Chaim disagreed and said that even if you're not circumcised, you're still Jewish. If I'm not mistaken, Reb Chaim quotes this story as well, but he might not. The last story I want to give you is that Rav Zevin reports that during the years of the draft, where you were drafted to the army, you had ways, if you were a yeshiva student, to get out of the draft by being appointed, even if you weren't really yet a rabbi, being appointed a rabbi at some institution or in a community, and not a real rabbi, but just a rabbi until you were no longer in the ages that you'd be drafted. And Reb Chaim refused, even though he had a son, Reb Elvo, and a son-in-law, Rav C. Glickson, I think it's Glickson they pronounce it. He refused to allow them to be included as rabbis because he says that it's a ziyuf. He says that we don't. If the government were to find out about this, then this will negatively affect all rabbis, and therefore Rav Elvo and his son-in-law were subject to the draft for a number of years, and because he didn't want to make them rabbis, as it were. That's the story which he tells from Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. In the note, he tells that there's a different version, that Reb Chaim was afraid that if you report who the rabbis are and the government changes their mind, then they'll know who's who. It's better just to keep them anonymous. But I would think that Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who was such a close student to Reb Chaim, knew the story. Okay, that's all I want to say about Ishim B'Shutot. As I said, there's a lot there. I want to now move on to the next book, tell you a little bit about this book, the new edition, La'or HaHalacha, for some reason not translated into English. I know Shlomo gave his theory last class as to why Ishim B'Shutot isn't translated into English, because same reason, associated, maybe it's too radical, like some of the things I say, but which I rejected that. And definitely, when you look at the Or Halacha, the essays in here are along the same lines as what you see in Hamodim Halacha. So I'm not sure why this wasn't translated. Now, it deals with a variety of issues from the standpoint of Halacha. Today, this sort of book, these sort of studies are common. But when Rav Zevin wrote it and it was first published in 46, there was nothing like it. Today, this is par for the course, and we have a million people who are experts in halacha, and I mean real experts, and of course there's all these so-called experts, and they do articles on all sorts of things, every aspect, but when Rav Zevin wrote his article on snow and halacha that I spoke about, who would have dreamed of writing such a thing? We have Sfarim now on every single aspect of halacha. I've given you so many examples. One line in the Shulchan Aruch is now a whole book. We have, I showed you a sefer on transsexuals in halacha. We have sorim on every little aspect of halacha. But this was unique when it appeared. Now, let me just tell you what he has, the table of contents. He begins with a very long section dealing with war. Anyone who wants to know about Jewish attitudes towards war and peace, of which there is a lot written about, and unfortunately, in the state of Israel, it's a constant. If you want to know halachic and not hashafic viewpoints of war, this is what you need to examine. Now, all about kibush and war today and the gittin they would give out and who has to go to war. Then he moves on. He talks about the Jewish state, Kedusha Sa'aretz. He has a very long article on Shemitah. One of the very, very first articles on Shemitah. Today, like I said, we have a million articles. And when I say an article that deals with the Heter Mechira and shows its basis, deals with Shemitah Bizman Hazeh, the mainstream viewpoint being that it's Derabbanan, the minority viewpoint being that it's D'oraisa. And the that it's the Balamor's position. I mentioned that because the bill mentioned the Balamor before, that it's not even a halacha, but it's not even rabbinic, but it's a minhag. And these are all positions which people today forget. Everyone talks about it, how it's a daraisa, daraisa. You see one of the best articles ever written on the Heter Mechir and on Shemitah. Then he has an essay on Hakel. He has an essay on women and mitzvah seseshas among Grama. An essay, lots of essays. An essay on Shir HaShirim in Halacha. An essay on the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Levi's Kuzari in Halacha. And not just, everyone knows about the Kuzari, he has a shita about the international dateline. The Baal HaMor also is known about the international dateline. But no, just aside from that, all other things that you can derive from the Kuzari, what he held in Halacha. An essay on the number 13. Lots of essays here. I don't need to go through them. The most famous of his discussions is Mishpat Shylock. And in the new edition, there's even Tosefet Devarim. This is on page 420, additions to the article. Not in the original one, but additions to the article on Shylock in the Halakha. So I mentioned last class, does your typical gadol, you see Shylock and Halakha, do they even have any idea? And you pointed out correctly that there's plenty of gadolim who do. Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Vinovitz, etc., etc. But I was speaking about an old-fashioned gadol from Eastern Europe, where they know who Shylock is, and perhaps I'm exaggerating, perhaps they would. Some certainly don't. The Merchant of Venice was put on last year by Al Pacino was Shylock. Maybe some of you listening heard it. The director of it was my friend Barry Adelstein. I even brought him out to Scranton to speak, and he gave a wonderful PowerPoint presentation about how Shylock has been portrayed throughout the decades. Because you can portray it in the negative light, or it can be very sympathetic. There was a bit of a chil hashem, I think, a couple years ago when this Haredi girls' school in London, which actually does very well on the various English tests, the A-levels, but the teenage girls refuse to study Merchant of Venice because it's anti-Semitic, they said. How do they know it's anti-Semitic if they haven't studied it yet? But Barry Adelstein, one of his pictures that he showed in was he took Al Pacino around Williamsburg. Barry Adelstein lives in Williamsburg. He's one of the hipsters, I guess. And he took him around, and you have a great picture of Barry, Al Pacino, and like three Satmar Hasidim all with their arms on each other. And what he said, he told this to the audience of non-Jews, of professors, of other people in Scranton, and they did not believe when he said it. They thought that Barry Adelstein was just making a joke. By the way, his newest play is Nathan Englander wrote a play on the Stalin years. It just opened, and Barry Adelstein's the director. What he said to them is that the Satmar Hasidim, in this picture with Al Pacino, they knew who Al Pacino was, but they had never heard of Shakespeare. And everyone laughed, thinking this is a joke. But it's not a joke. He meant it seriously. The Satmar Hasidim, they knew who Al Pacino was. They did not know who Shakespeare was. So there's no question that you find great rabbis who haven't seen. You say, show me you saw the movie, but the movie doesn't have Al Pacino in it. You had all these Italian guys who were going to see Shakespeare, or precisely because they wanted to see Al Pacino. They said it was a great performance. It has him. He made a movie with Al Pacino. Made a movie of he's Shylock. Okay, I didn't know that then. Sorry, I take that back. I have to make a note. I have to see it. He had done Shylock years ago on in the theater, and they brought it back. He wanted to do it. So the title of the article is Shylock in Halacha. Okay, who is Shylock before we understand what this is about? Well, he's invented by Shakespeare, but as in all his works, Shakespeare is using older versions. The pound of flesh theme dates back. Cecil Roth has an article on Merchant of Venice, and he says that it dates back to the 13th century, but the Jew is not always the villain. In one story from the 16th century that Roth quotes, a Jew and a non-Jew wager, and if the Jew wins, he gets 1,000 ducats, And if the Christian wins, he gets the pound of flesh from the Jew. So it's the Jew who's going to give up the pound of flesh. In this story, the Jew loses, but the Pope sets the penalty aside. Thank you, Shlomo. So let me give you just a quick summary from Merchant of Venice. I just pulled it off Wikipedia. You can find lots of summaries. Bassanio needs money in order to travel to Belmont so he can marry Portia. His friend Antonio tells him that if Bassanio can find someone to lend him the money, Antonio will guarantee it. Now, Shylock, the Jewish moneylender, hates Antonio, who's an anti-Semite, and wants to spit on him. Shylock says that he will lend Bassanio the money without interest, but if it can't be paid back, he is permitted to take a pound of flesh from Antonio, who's the guarantor of the loan. And, of course, the loan is not paid back. Antonio's ships are lost at sea, and Bassanio can't satisfy the loan. Shylock wants his revenge, even more so now that his daughter, Jessica, has eloped with a Christian named Lorenzo, taking a good amount of Shylock's wealth with her. So Shylock has Antonio arrested as the guarantor of the loan, brought to court. Bassanio hears what happens, raises the money, even twice the amount. He offers it to Shylock, but Shylock refuses. According to the contract, if the money was not given when it was supposed to be, Shylock can get his pound of flesh from Antonio, and that's what he wants, his pound of flesh. There's a case, a court case about this. Portia dresses up as a male lawyer and as in Shakespeare, as you can do in the theater. No one recognizes her, that she's a woman, but she asks Shylock to show mercy, and Shylock refuses. So the court must allow him to take his pound of flesh. At the last minute, though, Portia finds a flaw in the contract. He is permitted to remove the flesh, but he is not permitted to remove any blood of Antonio. If he were to shed any of Antonio's blood, the property would be forfeited under Venetian laws. She also says that he must cut exactly 1 pound, no more and no less. And if he's not exact, he is to be killed and all his property confiscated. Shylock, therefore, has to accept Bassanio's offer of money. Portia is able to prevent this by saying that Shylock has already in open court refused the money. And she then cites a law in which Shylock, who is a Jew, which means he's an alien, not a citizen, who attempted to take the life of a citizen, that is, of Antonio, because after taking his pound of flesh, he'd kill him, he would die, Antonio. He has forfeited all of his property, half to the government and half to Antonio, with his life at the mercy of the Duke. The Duke pardons Shylock's life. Antonio asks only for the income from Shylock's wealth until his death, but not the principal. And at Antonio's request, the Duke grants remission of the state's half of the forfeiture, but in return, Shylock must convert to Christianity and to make a will bequeathing his estate to his daughter Jessica and Lorenzo. So you see the great tragedy in the end, that Shylock, he himself is defeated in such a way that he has the most ultimate defeat. He has to convert to Christianity. Well, who is Shylock supposed to be? Most people don't know about the Jews of Venice, and I invite all of you to come with us again this summer to Italy, where we will end up in Venice. The link is not yet up on the website. I still have to do one or two things, but the Central Europe link, it is up. You will learn a lot about this. But some have assumed that Shylock is a Spanish Jew, knowing that there was a good deal of Spanish Jews in Venice, and the Spanish Jews have a lot of hatred against Christianity. There was a Spanish and Portuguese community in Venice, and there was also called the Ponentine. There also was a Levantine community, and these were also Spanish Jews who had lived in the Levanto for years longer. They didn't come directly from Spain to Venice. But that's not true. Shylock was not a Spanish Jew. He was a moneylender. In the Venetian ghetto, only German Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, were permitted to be moneylenders, not the Spanish Jews. The other communities were restricted by law to commerce. and they did control a great deal of the maritime trade of Venice. The Germans were Jews, were Ashkenazi Jews, that is, were tolerated solely on condition that they engage in money lending. Later, they were, in the 17th century, they were given permission to do other things, to trade, and years, even in later years, they were even allowed to become doctors. But at the time Shakespeare is writing, they were only allowed to be involved as moneylenders. And this moneylenders, by the way, was sort of a welfare system. It was designed for the poor people, and there was the rate of interest was set so that the poor people would have be able to borrow money. I'm talking about poor Christians. Okay, so returning to Revzevin's article. Does Shylock's contract have any validity? In halakha, let's assume you went to a beis din, you had such a contract. Are you permitted to take someone's pound of flesh if such a person agrees to it? And let's assume for a minute, by taking the pound of flesh, he would not die, although the implication of what Portia argued was that Shylock was trying to kill him so by taking his pound of flesh. But we can have both options. Would he be killed or not be killed? Rav Zevin says that according to Jewish law, Shylock's contract could never be honored because people do not have control over their bodies. However, he does note that according to the Minchas Linuch, and the Minchas Linuch has all sorts of strange views, non-conventional views, perhaps because the Minchas Linuch is not a work halacha l'maisa, a practical halacha, he can have these ideas, but according to the Minchas Linuch, a person can give someone else permission to wound him. Obviously, you can't give someone permission to kill you, but if you could take a pound of flesh, then you'd only be wounded. And that might be what, what Shylock is really all about, even in the original. Although, as I mentioned, Portia does say that his life should be forfeit because he was trying to kill Antonio. But in terms of wounding, the Minchas Linuch says you are permitted. And if you think of it, the reason we can't, we all know that we're not allowed to injure ourselves. We don't own our bodies. We can't do tattoos, all these sorts of things. But you have to look in the Minchas Linuch. He explains that, no, you can give someone else permission to wound you. Another interesting article in the book deals with Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai in Halacha. The title of it is L'shitos Beis Shammai Beis Hillel. In this article, he tries to show that there's a line that you can connect between the two schools, between different positions of the two schools. What he calls L'shitoso, that means you can examine different viewpoints of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai in different disputes, and you can see a line, as it were. To be honest, I'm not convinced. I find that quite unconvincing, but I wanted to call your attention to what he says. Now, as I mentioned before, many of his articles were put together in the three-volume work Sofri Musfarim, which is a collection of his book reviews and all sorts of things. I could have, I want to end today, or if not today, the first few minutes of next class, I could give you all sorts of interesting things from these articles. Every article, he picks an interesting chiddush, he picks an interesting point, and he talks about it. It's in all the book reviews, and then he has articles and other things. So, but let me just point out one thing, which I found interesting. He's speaking about a figure that we've spoken about in the past, Rav Chanoch Ayis, the Marcheshes. The great Marcheshes, I mentioned him in my talk in Edison, a few people were there, that he is a Mizrahi Rav, and even after he leaves Mizrahi, we spoke about why he left, because of this Mizrahi put up a different rabbi to be Rav of Vilna. He still remained interested in religious Zionism, and Keren Kayem, and all these sorts of things. Rav Chanoch Ayis's father was named Tzvi Hirsch Edelman. He was one of these religious maskilim who published material from manuscript, and Rav Zevin says that it's quite interesting. Why, incidentally, they have different last names, that I don't know. We have to investigate that. He says that normally we find the Noheg Shel Olamenu. We find that if you have a maskil, even if he's bedakdik in mitzvos, his children usually, become, as we would say today, go off the path. But that's common. And we have many examples of this. And here we have a case where Tzvi Hirsch Edelman is a religious maskil, and yet his son becomes a traditional Gadol B'Yisrael. Not a typical thing. And that's a very interesting point that Rav Zevin makes. We have some other examples of this. The one that comes to mind is Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, who we had classes on. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes is a religious maskil. He's a Talmudist, but he's also a maskil. His son, he has a son, Yitzchak Chayes, who's a traditional Rav. Not a hint of Haskalah interests or historical interest. He wrote a volume of Chuvos called Sedei Yitzchak. So it is unusual. In 1959, the Mizrahi wanted to have Rav Zevin stand on their ticket. That is the National Religious Party. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote to Rav Zevin and told him not to. They said he should remain above politics. And I guess by not being a member of Knesset, he was above politics, but not really, I would think, because he was always a member of Mizrahi. When I say member, I don't know how you actually are a member. He wrote for the newspaper every week. He signed the placards telling people to vote for the Mizrahi party. He was very much in their camp, although in later years there was a bit of a break. When I mentioned already about when he came out against drafting yeshiva students. But he never becomes chief rabbi, or he doesn't stand for chief rabbi. The Lubavitcher Rebbe tells him not to, and also not to become a member of Knesset. We have had Talmid Chachamim members of Knesset, no one at the level of Rav Zevin. He also comes to the Israeli population's, cognizance. Through a famous article he wrote. It's called Ashamnu Bagatsnu. It's a play on Ashamnu Bagadnu that we say on the High Holidays. And let me tell you the story. The story, for those who want to see it in more detail, is found on page 28 and 29 of Rav Zevin's grandson's introduction to Ishim B'Shitot. What happened basically is that the chief rabbinate removed a hashgacha from a certain place, from a certain meat-producing place. And this meat producer took the case to put an appeal to the Bagatz, Beit Din Gavoh LeTzedek, the Israeli Supreme Court, secular court. And the Supreme Court, and this was the first time, by the way, that a decision of the chief rabbin had been appealed. Subsequently, there have been other cases where they've done similar things. The High Court ordered that the Moetzet Rabbanut HaRashit, that members of the Chief Rabbinic Council, come before the court and explain why they're not giving the Hechsher. Explain and justify why they took it away. Rav Zevin gave us, there was a big gathering, a protest gathering. Rav Zevin spoke. This was later published. And he said that... and that's where he coined the phrase, Ashamnu Bagatsnu. That this Bagats, the Supreme Court, how terrible it is that the Supreme Court... And then he goes on, the whole story, that Rav Zevin tells them that they cannot even answer. The High Court. The High Court has no business interfering whatsoever, and they never did reply to it. And this is the famous expression, Ashamnu Bagatsnu. Now, there's just two more things I want to talk about Rav Zevin. It'll take maybe 5 minutes. One deals with the Yossela Schumacher case, if any of you know that, and Rav Zevin's role in that in the, 1950s, I believe, or early 60s. And one other point, but beginning next class, we will finish Rav Zevin within 5 minutes or so, and we will then move on to this figure, the great Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, one of the greatest poskim of the last couple hundred years, without question, the most important Lithuanian Russian post-sig of the end of the 19th century. Getting back, let me get the picture. Rodney asks, who the Rav in the picture above Rav Zevin is. That is Rav Herzog. And that picture would have been taken in Heichal Shlomo, I presume, or maybe in the chief rabbinic court system. The person to his right looks like Abba Eben. I can't be certain, but it looks very much like Abba Eben. I'm not sure what Abba Eben would be doing at, you did have politicians, but he was not, Abba Eben was never an Israeli politician. He always was foreign minister or ambassador. So we have plenty of pictures of the rabbis at places like Heichal Shlomo with prime ministers, various ministers of interior. But I can't imagine why you'd have Abba Eben there. Any other questions? It seems that I'm wearing black. Well, I guess you could say this is black. Yes. We spoke about Yisrael. Did you hear the classes? Already last semester we spoke about how he was a Zionist from day one, Rav Zevin, and remained a Zionist his entire life. It isn't something that developed. It's not like Rav Soloveitchik that after the Holocaust he changes his mind and joins Mizrahi. From the beginning, Rav Zevin had Zionist leanings, and when he arrives in Eretz Yisrael in the 1930s, he immediately identifies with the religious Zionist circles, with Mizrahi, with Meir Bar-Ilan, with Mossad Rav Kook, with Rehuda Leib Maimon. So he is one of these figures who, like others we've dealt with, like Rav Herzog, whose picture is right above him, he was always a Zionist. The fact that he's Chabad doesn't change matters because he's not Lubavitch. If he would have been Lubavitch, he couldn't have been a Zionist, because Lubavitchers have to follow the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And Lubavitch has always been anti-Zionist, but he is Chabad, not Lubavitch. So although he looked up to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and turned to the Lubavitcher Rebbe for guidance, the Lubavitcher Rebbe did not have a veto. Either this Lubavitcher, either Rav Nachum Mendel or the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. He's not the only one. Rav Shlomo Aronson, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, when he passes away, I think it's in 32. That's when Rabbi Soloveitchik wants to become chief rabbi. He too came from a Chabad background. Rav Kook also. Rav Kook comes from the Kapus Babroisk branch, his mother. Oh, yes, he considered Lubavitcher Rebbe a very significant scholar. I think I told the story already that Yischezkel Sarna once got angry at Rav Zevin and said that your Rebbe is an apikoros and your Rebbe is an apikoros, something like that. I confirmed the story with Rav Sarna's son. He said that Rav Sarna later apologized to Rav Zevin. Yes, he considered the Lubavitcher Rebbe a significant scholar. Everyone considered the Lubavitcher Rebbe a significant scholar, even the people who opposed the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe is a genius of geniuses. I don't know when he ever had time to learn. From the time he became a Rebbe, he's meeting with people. He clearly only needed about 3-4 hours a night of sleep. He'd meet with people routinely till 3-4 in the morning, and he's meeting with people all day, and yet he knew all of Shas, post-game, other stuff. Everyone assumes, and everyone knows that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is an unbelievable scholar. Okay, well, thank you all for coming. This is the end of the third class. I'll hold off till Shlomo. If Shlomo's typing, thank you. Well, thank you for coming, Shlomo. Thank you for your comments and corrections, all of you, and we'll see you next week. Good night, everyone.